Look, tonight, you think, what do you do with all this information about faith? In other words, what is God's perspective on it? What does he really want to accomplish through us? And to start thinking like God thinks and what he has in mind for us is really a hard project, because we are so earthly and human in our thinking. If you'd turn to Psalms chapter 8, please. I think this is a prophecy about Christ, but I think also it applies to us, because it's David talking here, and there's some things he can't understand about God, and it's probably the same things we can't understand about God. Psalms 8, 3 to 6. It says, Psalms 8, 3 to 6. It says, when I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon, the stars, which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him? And the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hath crowned him with glory and honor. Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hand. Thou hast put all things under his feet. And then it has a list of things after that. Now, we say, well, that prophecy applies to Christ. But, as we talked about a couple nights ago, everything that belongs to Christ also belongs to us. The authority that Jesus Christ had is also the authority that we have. The power that he has, we have. It's totally available to us. And, see, David couldn't understand here. He says, I don't understand how you made everything and yet you're mindful of man. He says, you're not only mindful of him, you put everything you've created under his command and his control. Now, if that's true, we are operating almost totally opposite of that. I can't believe how many Christians are absolutely terrified by the world today. Oh, we don't want to get out there in the world. We don't want our little kids out there. I mean, they're absolutely terrified. I mean, they go to all sorts of extremes. Now, that is not what the Bible's talking about. God says we are in charge. The problem is, because of lack of faith, we have allowed Satan to take charge. And our job by faith is to re-wrestle the world from Satan. And I think God has in mind some places and some ways to start. One, I think, first of all, he wants us to take charge of our family. Whether it's our kids in our family, or whether it's our in-laws, or whether it's our son-in-laws, daughter-in-laws, or whether it's our parents or grandparents, all that. I mean, he has places in a family for a very important reason. Like, I'm sure a lot of you have read some of James Dobson's book on Dare to Discipline and some things on kids. I heard him speak once, and he told about his great-grandfather. Before his great-grandfather died, he got the idea. He thought, the greatest contribution that I could make to the world is the spiritual well-being of my children. So he took from 11 until 12 o'clock every day, the latter years of his life, to pray for the spiritual well-being of his children. Before he died, he got the assurance from God that the next four generations would all be Christian. Now, James is one of the fourth generation. He says, God far exceeded that promise to my great-grandfather. He says, first of all of the four generation have become Christians. He says, every girl has become a preacher's daughter, a preacher's wife. And every son has become a preacher with the exception of one, and that's James. He's a child psychiatrist or some other title. He's probably had more impact than all of them combined. You think, let's see, that's a pretty phenomenal story. No, it shouldn't amaze us at all. All his grandfather did was line himself up with what God already had in mind. And he decided to take charge, that's all. That's the only thing that's happened. Or another thing we should do is take charge of our neighborhood. For some reason, God has put us there. Like a lady back in Iowa, They were moving from town out to a little acreage. So before they moved, she prayed, God, I'd like to have a spiritual impact on all the neighbors. I don't know how many there. I don't know them, but that's my goal. After 3.5 years, I talked to them. She says, well, see, I didn't know what to do. But she says, I did tell God, I will lead them in Bible study if they will ask me. She says, I wouldn't know how to get a Bible study started. So if you have them ask me to get in Bible study, I'll lead them. She says, when I talked to her, she says, well, there's 8 neighbors. 2 of them were Christians. 5 of them have become Christians, and 1 we're not sure about yet. I think that's terrific. But it shouldn't amaze us. Because it's exactly what God had planned all along for every person who are willing to volunteer and say, God, I am willing to line myself up with what you had in mind. Or if we talk just business associates or people we bump into all the time. Like up here, one of the schools in Colorado, a wrestler became a Christian, and he got the burden for the rest of the wrestling team. And on one bus trip, there was 20 guys on the bus, and he went from seat to seat presenting the gospel to them. By the time they got there, 2/3 of them had made decisions for Christ. After the meet, they had a little celebration, becoming Christians and winning the meet. You think, hey, that's good. Of course it's good, because that's what God had in mind. That's what he wants to accomplish for everybody who's willing to say, God, I'm available for you to work your plan through me. Now, I've tried to look in the Bible to figure out, let's see, what God has in mind for everyone. It's very interesting. Every work that God started, it looks like he has 4 things in mind. Number 1, he starts with 1 person. I mean, everyone I've read starts with 1 person. Number 2, he tells that person to multiply or that he will multiply him, one or the other. Number 3, he says, I want your work to affect the whole world. And number 4, he says, I want it to last till the end times or till Jesus comes. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that something? Start with 1 person. He tells them to multiply. He tells them he wants it to affect the whole world and last till Jesus comes. Now, we say, oh, yes, those works of God. Campus Crusade. Let's see. Salvation Army. The Navigators. The Presbyterian Church. Now, wait a minute. That's not what God had in mind back there. Now, that's not what he was talking about. He talked to families back there. Let's take the first one. Adam and Eve. He picked 1 person, Adam. And you know what he told him? Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. There it is. Well, granted, they didn't turn out so well, his generation. In fact, they only lasted 6 chapters. Well, we come up to Genesis chapter 6. And we have Noah, his wife, their 3 sons, and their 3 wives. And God called Noah, and you know the story about the ark. But when they walked off the ark, do you know what God told Noah? Exactly the same words he told Adam. Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. That generation didn't turn out so well either. In fact, they lasted 5 chapters, and we come to Genesis chapter 12. Would you all turn to that, please? Genesis chapter 12, because God starts another work. And this is a story about Abraham, or Abram, as he's mentioned here. This is the calling of Abram. Genesis 12:1. It says, Now the Lord said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house into a land that I will show thee. And I will make thee a great nation. And I will bless thee and make thy name great. And thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee and curse them that curses thee. And in all, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Isn't that interesting? Same thing. He picked 1 person. Told him he would multiply him. He wanted him to affect the whole earth and last till the end times. Exactly the same. Now, Abraham, he could have really been stumped by this. Because God says, Abraham, your descendants are going to bless every family in the earth. Abraham Can you imagine the going away party they had for Abraham? Abraham, well, where is you going? Oh, that way. Oh, sort of a holiday, kind of a vacation. No. I'm not coming back. You're what? You're going that way and not coming. Yeah, he says, that's right. They said, well, now, Abraham, explain to us something. Let's see, what is the purpose of this trip? Oh, he says, I know that. I'm going to start a nation. Now, let me tell you something. Nation starters are so hard to come by today that three religions claim Abraham. I mean, those nation starters aren't a dime a dozen. Now, Abraham, you're what? You're going that way. You're not coming back. You're going to start a nation. What motivated you to do this? Oh, I know that, too. I heard a voice. That's what we thought. I mean, strange. Not only that, Abraham was 75 years old and couldn't have children. Sarah was no spring chicken at 65. And she couldn't have children. But they launched out. And they were out there for 15 years. And now Abraham was 90 and Sarah was 80. And nothing had happened. And so they decided to take matters in their own hand. And Abraham had a child by Hagar, Ishmael. And you think, well, good deal, 33% increase, you know, in 1 year. God says, not so fast there, Abraham. He doesn't count. You think, oh, poor old Abraham, he didn't have faith. Wait a minute. Think how embarrassing it would be every Christmas to send home your Christmas card with just you and Sarah's picture on it. I mean, you know, he did have a little pressure going on around there. And not only that, he had announced he was going out and start a nation. You know, and here 15 years had gone by. Well, another 10 years went by, and finally, what happened? They had a son, Isaac. Abraham was 100, and Sarah was 90. And then, some time went on. They were up to 3 then, after 25 years. 3, the whole congregation. That's it. One to preach, one to usher, and one to take the offering. Nice little pair there. See, and then God told Abraham to take Isaac to the mountain and sacrifice him. Now, I used to, you know, when you hear in Sunday school, I used to think Isaac was a little kid. The way historians have it figured out, he was probably between 20 and 40 years old. Let's say he was 20, the minimum. So they'd been out there 45 years, and they're still up to 3. But Abraham obeyed and took Isaac, and you know the story. God provided a ram for a sacrifice, and they came back down. And it was a while longer, because they were up to 3, and you think, oh, good deal. Well, Isaac got married, except Sarah had died, and they were back to 3. It took a long time. In fact, it took 215 years to get up to 70. But man, look what's happened in the world today because of Abraham. Would you turn over to 15, please? And it tells us what's going to happen. This is when they were walking back down the mountain. Whoop, I said 15. Let's see, it must be 22 here. Turn on over there. 22:15. And here's what happened. Now, 45 years had gone by, and an angel appeared. 22:15, it says, and the angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of the second time and said, by myself have I sworn, saith the Lord, for because thou hast done this thing, and hast not withheld thy son, thy only son, that in blessing I will bless thee, in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven, as the sand which is on the seashore, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemy. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. In fact, we are here tonight because of one reason. Abraham obeyed God. Isn't that terrific? Now, generations have gone by, centuries have gone by, but the promises still stand because Abraham and Sarah decided to believe. And granted, the whole rest of the Old Testament talks about the descendants of Abraham. Well, they didn't turn out so well either, and God started another work, and he started with Christ. Exactly the same thing. One, and he multiplied himself into some disciples. His plan was what? To affect the whole world and last until he came back. Exactly the same. In fact, the last words that Jesus, the last recorded words that we have of Jesus speaking on earth are found in Acts 1:8. And they were on top of the mountain, and he said to them, but ye shall receive power after that the Holy Ghost has come upon you. Now listen, and you shall be witnesses. He didn't say you might be witnesses. He says, you shall be witnesses unto me in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost part of the earth. And then it says, they saw him ascending into heaven, and a cloud covered him. And they kept looking up. In fact, they stood there so long, two angels had to come and say, hey, you guys, back to Jerusalem. We were just leaving, angel. We were. I mean, they couldn't even get on with project number one, back to Jerusalem. Can you imagine their conversation on the way home? Did you hear what he said? We'd be witnesses in Jerusalem. Now that Jesus fellow, he has good heart, but he must have a poor memory. I wonder if he remembers 40 days ago they crucified him in Jerusalem. And did you hear what he said? Judea, those Jews don't like us. And someone else, he said Samaria, and I don't like those Samaritans. And they didn't. Then he says, the uttermost part of the earth. Doesn't he know Rome is in charge? And anyway, I mean, even if they weren't in charge, the printing press won't be invented for 1,000 years and TV for 2,000, so how could we do it? See, we see all these things as to what to do and what not to do. See, we can analyze. We say, well, God had a purpose for Adam, and he did. And God, think Abraham. Oh, well, God, Abraham's kind of special. Oh, is that right? Listen to this. It says, this is Isaiah 51:2, and it tells what we are to learn from Abraham. I'll read it to you from the Living. It says, Isaiah 51:2, yes, think about your ancestors, Abraham and Sarah, from whom you came. Now listen, you worry at being so small and few, but Abraham was only one when I called him. But when I blessed him, he became a great nation. Abraham and Sarah are no different than we are, except they decided to believe God. And they decided to say, God, we want you to fulfill everything you had planned in the eternity past through us. We don't want to get to heaven with one thing missing. And Abraham was very frail. You know, all the stuff. He went down to Egypt. I mean, fouled up. And I mean, he had problems exactly like we do. Except through it all, he decided to believe that God was going to do something. A decision to believe. A decision to believe. That's what happened. He didn't produce much else. But he didn't have to. Because if we believe, God will produce it. And that's what he wants us to do. See, as we see all of that, especially the disciples coming back down the mountain, going to Jerusalem, and mulling over in their minds the things that Jesus told them. You know what they had to decide? Exactly the same thing we have to decide tonight. And that is, do we believe that God will give us power? He said that, but you shall receive power, period. Ooh, you shall receive power. Let's see, do I believe that God will give me power? That's the question we have to answer. Do I believe that God will give me a power to accomplish what he has in mind? That's the thing we have to wrestle with. If you're wrestling with these other things, they're easy. Here's the tough one. See, do I really believe that? But it hinges on, am I willing to believe? And a lot of times, it's hard. See, people say, well, are you saying we should sit back and do nothing? No, I'm saying you should sit back and believe. And let me tell you something. When it doesn't look so good out there, it's a lot harder to believe than do something. In fact, I found a little phrase. I wish it was in the Greek or something. I don't want to check it out in some Greek guy because he might not be in there. But it was in the Phillips in Romans 3. And it says this. Paul says, well, what about the law? Should we keep doing the law? And Paul says, of course. Or, you know, that little dialogue he had there on the law. And they said this. It says, you should trade your achieving for believing. I thought, yeah, that's what we need to do. See, we're so busy trying to achieve for God that we don't have time to believe. And it takes time to believe. And it takes effort to believe. And it's hard to believe. When all the odds are against you, it's easy to start achieving. That's easy. See, it's hard to believe, but that's what God wants. Now, see, when we see all that, see, God isn't not in us just to be something, and He is that, but not only. See, He's in us to achieve something by faith. And we have the most amazing story of this. You remember the crossing at the Red Sea? Boy, it was marvelous. I mean, the Red Sea actually opened. Now, those Israelis, they didn't wade through knee-deep in mud. It says they walked through on dry ground. And not only that, the miracle that followed was almost bigger. The Egyptian army was in the midst of the Red Sea. The chariot wheels started coming off, and about that time they said, "Let's get out of here," and it was too late. Splash. I mean, it was super. Boy, I bet they thought, good night, we made it through just in time. The gate closed. Boy, that, the border closing was fast then, wasn't it? Pretty complete. Now, see, God, He wants to do something in us. But we're so busy achieving. You think, well, how do you change? It's like this. How many of you here attend at least three religious activities a week? Like Sunday morning church, Sunday school, and a Bible study. How many three a week? Let's see your hands. Okay, how many of you, how many four a week? Maybe we got some four. How many four a week? Okay, choir, all that. Four a week. Okay, all you four a weekers, think like this. Think some heathen, just some rank heathen that you know. You got them in mind? I mean, just think of them. Everybody got one in mind or two? How many of you think, if you went and told this person, you said, let me tell you what activities I'm in for God. I go to Sunday morning church, I go to Sunday school, and I sing in the choir, and we have this Bible study. You know, we learn the Bible and you memorize scripture and that sort of thing. We do those for you. What? You take your summer vacation at a religious thing for a week? Well, yeah, we do that too. You give money? You mean dollar, I do that too. No, we give that bigger percent. Ooh. How many of you, the heathen you're thinking about, how many, if you told him that, or her, how many think they'd be drawn closer to God and wanting to get in on God? No, huh? Hey, you're doing the wrong thing or something. Maybe you should drop back to two, or maybe you should increase to eight. How many think they'd be more impressed if you had eight things? I go to Sunday school, church, what's the matter? You're doing the wrong thing, or something's wrong here, right? Isn't our goal to see people won to Christ and brought in the kingdom and the fellowship? Isn't that the goal? What's the matter? Here's what's the matter. People are not impressed at all with what you do for God or activities you're involved in that seem to be doing something for God. They are not impressed. In fact, the more they find out about it, the more they hate you. And they say, hey, boy, are they religious. Boy, do they act better than they're always running off, you know. They get up some ungodly hour on Sunday morning and make noise backing out of the garage. They go to some meeting over there. They got a little steeple on top of the building. And, boy, I can't figure it out. And they go on Sunday night. Man, I mean, sports are on. They cut it off and go down to that meeting. And I can't believe it, but they take weekends when Kansas City is playing and they go to those religious retreats. See, we're repelling people. What is the problem? Here's the problem. People are not impressed with what we do for God, but they will melt inside when they find out God is doing something for us. They absolutely do not know how to cope with that. They have no mechanism whatsoever inside to cope with that. In fact, a lady came to my house and she says, she said, we were in a little Bible study, and she says, I was praying about witnessing to my neighbor. And she says, every time I'd go over there and bring up a little answer to prayer or something, she said, the neighbor would say, yes, we go to church. We're very happy with our Sunday school. She says, just kill the conversation. She says, I'd go home, and I'd pray, trying to get an idea, and I'd go over there, and I'd mention something, and Lacey, we do go to church and we're very happy with our Sunday school. She said there were just no inroads whatsoever. She says, except for one thing. She said, one day the neighbor lady drove by and there was a new car sitting in our driveway. So the neighbor lady called up and she says, hey, what's the deal on the new car? I didn't know you were getting a new car. I mean, how? This is kind of a quick decision. Lady says, I didn't know what to tell her, but I thought, well, maybe I better tell her the truth. She said, well, no, we weren't really planning on it, but we go to this little Bible study, and someone in the group got the burden that they should give us a brand new car free. You know what the lady said? She says, could I come over and talk to you? I think she says, I think your faith is different than ours. That's right. See, when we let God do something for us, then people see that our faith is different than theirs. If we're out trying to do something for God, it's exactly the same. Now, would you all turn over to Joshua, please? Because we have a testimony here of a person as to what happened about the Red Sea. Joshua chapter 2, and this little testimony by Rahab. They sent out the two spies, they landed at Rahab's house, and Rahab gave them this little report. Let's start reading about 10. Oh, let's go up one more, the 9. Joshua 2:9. Here's what it says. Joshua 2:9. And she said unto the men, I know that the Lord has given you this land, and that your terror is fallen upon us, and all the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. How would you like to be a spy in Joshua's army and go back and report? Say, boy, they're terrified over there. But listen to the next thing. Here's why. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt. Aha. It didn't say, we heard how you outsmarted the Egyptians and built those bridges quick and made it out in the fog, because there were fog in there somewhere we heard about. See, had they done that, they thought, you're clever, so are we. Come fight us. But when they heard what God did for them, they says, we were terrified. We didn't know how to cope. We didn't know what to do. In fact, verse 11, it says, and as soon as we heard these things, our hearts did melt. Neither did there remain any more courage in any of our men, any man, because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and earth beneath. The battle was already won, and they hadn't assembled the army yet. They were already evangelized, and no gospel teams had gone out yet. Not even a singing group with 14, you know, speakers. We think, how did that happen? The way that happened was they let God work for them, which is totally different than us working for God. But it takes effort to believe. And you're going to go home with that list, and you're going to be excited. And there's going to be 3 months from now or 2 weeks from now, you're going to go through a big struggle. Number 6 on the list, we really want it. And it's going to look like you're going the other direction. It's going to look like you put exactly the opposite thing on that list from circumstances. Then comes the test of believing. Do I believe that? Do I believe that? Am I going to stick with it and believe? Because, see, that's what God wants to do. He wants to work through us. The most exciting seminar I had last year, well, one of three most exciting ones, was at Elliott, Iowa. And I wrote and asked if I could come there. Because they wrote me a little letter. Here's what had happened. There was a whole group of couples, about 15 of them. They had all raised, grown up together in high school. They kind of married everybody in between. They were all farming. Little town, Elliott's a town of about 1,200. And they were going through the book, God Can Make It Happen. And they came making out lists and things like that. And they came to the place. One couple, everyone had kids except this one couple. They couldn't have kids, and they were trying to adopt, and they'd been working on it 2, 3, 4 years, and finally came to the place, hey, we don't have kids, so we'll call you. Well, they put on their list, we'll adopt a child. So the class kind of all knew about it, and so they came to the chapter on make a faith deposit. So someone in the class suggested, they said, why don't we Why don't we as a class make a faith deposit for them? They said, well, what would be a good one? Or they said, why don't we just have a baby shower? You know, that's kind of a logical thing. I mean, nothing mystical about it. You know, you need it, so they had it. But they put it in the paper. You know, those little towns, those little newspapers, that, you know, that'd be a half a page, one baby shower in Elliott, Iowa. So they wrote it up, baby shower and all that. Well, they thought, ooh, let's see, we're kind of on the spot. So the next chapter is on expectant spirit. So they were talking the next Sunday, what should we do to have an expectant spirit? They thought, well, maybe we should pray, someone suggested, maybe we should pray that we get the baby this week. So they thought, well, let's have some prayer. And someone in the prayer meeting prayed, God, Thursday is the day we want him. Thursday. You know everybody, you know how they, Thursday, yeah. You know what happened? On Tuesday, they got a phone call. You know, it says, we got your baby. If you come down here Thursday, you can have it. And they found out it was born the day that they had the shower. Now, when I was there for the seminar, it was a Methodist church. It seated about 450, and it was absolutely packed, wall to wall. There were even some Baptists there, and that is a miracle, just getting them in there. You know what? They wanted to come see what God was doing in the Methodist church in Elliott, Iowa. But see, God was working, and when God starts working, you're going to have problems, because people are going to want to see. That's what happened in the New Testament. A little healing meeting, right? Jesus had a little healing. Man, it says the whole town gathered. Why? Because God was working. That's why. It wasn't that they were working for God. It's that God was working for them. But that's what we have to do. Now you think, let's see, how do we translate this? See, how do we translate this into real life? Because that's what we want, and we want it way down the line. I think what we should do is take Jabez's formula, because I think it's absolutely phenomenal. And it's found in 1 Chronicles chapter 4. We don't know much about Jabez at all. 1 Chronicles 4:9. Here's the history of it. We'll read it in two verses. But also we'll read the results that happened. In all, this is just a list of names, you know. Hard name begat hard name, and he lived so many years, and he begat hard, and on and on and on. But clunk, for some reason the Holy Spirit saw fit to stop at Jabez and say two verses about him. It says this, 4:9. And Jabez was more honorable than his brother. And his mother called his name Jabez, saying, because I bear him in sorrow. Now, we don't know whether Jabez's father had died during the time she was pregnant or they were in captivity. We just don't know that. Except one thing, there was sorrow in the family. And it says his mother called his name Jabez because she bare him in sorrow. And that's not a very good entry into life. But listen to the next verse. It says, and Jabez called on the God of Israel, saying, oh, that thou wouldest bless me indeed, enlarge my coast, and that thy hand might be with me, and thou wouldest keep me from evil. Now listen. And God granted him that which he requested. And then they go down to more names. But see, he prayed for four things. One, he says, bless me. He wanted spiritual enlargement. I want to be a spiritual person is what he wanted. Next, he says, enlarge my coast. He says, I want a bigger influence out there. Number three, he says, that thy hand might be with me. He says, God, I want to do it by your power, not by my might. And fourth, he says, keep me from evil. I want to be a finisher. Four things, spiritual enlargement, a bigger work, God's power, and be a finisher. And then it says, and God granted him that which he requested. Now, we have no record here of what happened afterwards, like we do with Abraham, that goes on and on, and what happened, and who's what, and all. We don't have that. But heaven will tell. And heaven will tell, see, for any of us who make a decision, say, God, I want to be a spiritual, godly, holy person. And two, I want you to use me on a broader sphere.
Big.
Maybe the whole world. I'm available. And then, God, I want to do it by your power, and I want to be a finisher. The day that I fall in the grave, I want to make sure it's your word saying, well done, now good and faithful servant. That's all. But see, we get to choose now what influence we're going to have. And you say, I don't have talent. Good. God doesn't need any. I don't have ability. Fine. We got too much now. See, but what we do desperately need today is trade our achieving to believing, because that is what produces, and that's what produces for all eternity. And if you make those decisions, fantastic things will continue to happen.